Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret are joined by Dr. William Shao, the K.T. Lee Professor of Economics at the Harvard School of Public Health. In the Tech Report segment, you'll hear about Fairfield University's use of simulation mannequins to train nursing students. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Margaret Flinter.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea pays tribute to the 50th anniversary of the anti-segregation freedom rides.
They were highlighting something that, you know, other people wanted to ignore. We also want to highlight an issue that could get ignored if it wasn't for people pointing it out.
Food and Freedom Rides, organized by a group called Live Real, continues this journey for justice, but now with food as a focus. In the same way that riders in 1961 worked to change the most urgent issue of their generation, racial injustice, Live Real seeks to do the same thing about our industrialized food system. 13 young leaders kicked off their road trip in August in Birmingham, Alabama, then traveled up the Midwestern states before heading off to the California coast in early September. They traveled through 8 states in total, spreading awareness about America's broken food system and the impact that that has on health, on our workers, and on the environment. The riders were not only teaching communities about federal food policy, but they are gathering stories and innovations from communities that can inspire others. Honoring the Freedom Riders while at the same time focusing on this injustice and empowering a new generation of leaders, now that's a bright idea.
Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. William Shao, internationally recognized for his work on health systems design. He's the K.T. Lee Professor of Economics at Harvard School of Public Health. Welcome, Dr. Shao. You've spent most of your career studying and designing health systems both here and around the world, and you're recognized internationally for your work. So from Mexico to China and many countries in between, you've been telling people about what the best system might be for them. Tell us here what America might do to improve its health system, learning from others, something that might improve our quality, increase our safety, and control cost.
The problem face United States is not unique. That's cost escalation and uninsured people, as well as quality of care. Other countries are actually walking ahead of United States. We learn throughout the world you cannot get universal coverage unless you made it compulsory. There are roughly, even if you give subsidy to the poor people, there will be a large number of people who believe they are invulnerable. And so they will not buy insurance. And when they get sick or they get in an accident, they just become a free rider on the rest of the people, get uncompensated care. So all the middle income or the advanced countries have put in compulsory national health insurance other than South Africa. Okay? So we, if we want to be in the companionship of South Africa, that's our choice. The second part is controlling cost escalation. The world only found one complicated solution. One is you have to change the payment system from fee-for-service payment system that encourage the physicians to do more, regardless of the medical procedure or test is necessary or not, then their revenue will go up. The world learned that you have to shift away from that kind of incentive system to a case payment system and or to a global budget system. And the United States is trying that, but it's understandable hospitals and doctors do not like it. And that's the political resistance we face. And we see that in other countries, too. So, again, it's not unique to the United States. However, I think what's unique to the United States is we have spent so much money on health care. We are denying ourselves to other public goods like better education or investment in research and so forth. In terms of improved quality of care, that's a tougher problem. First of all, it's hard to define what's quality of care. It's a really nice term, but it's ill-defined, and a great deal of quality of care cannot be measured. So the world, throughout the world, countries are groping with that problem without really a good solution. We only have partial solutions, like you pay people bonus if they do more prevention. Let's say doctors can help the patients to keep the blood pressure under control, or diabetic patients have better biomarkers. But that's only disease specific. Other kind of quality is hard to define and measure. So my basic message is United States can really learn a great deal from other countries, and we do not have to put ourselves up as guinea pigs.
Well, Dr. Shaw, I think that's a great lead in to perhaps asking you about, let's just take one country, and let's take China, though you've been involved, as Mark said, in so many. So you have this an economic, rapidly growing country that's trying to redesign care, redesign financing, improve outcomes, and to do it hopefully without repeating mistakes of the past in other countries, and to really forge some new territory. So maybe you could just share with us from your work in China, what are some of the innovations in providing access to care and redesigning and refinancing the system there?
First, China learned that to give people financial access to health care, then you have to have a universal health insurance. You're correct. China had very poor insurance programs, even up to about 6 years ago. But since 2003, China made a concerted effort to make social health insurance available to everyone. So by beginning of this year, China has 92% of the people covered under one of the three insurance programs they have. And they aim to reach at least 95, if not 97%, in another 5 years. So in a way, China is ahead of the United States in terms of insurance coverage right now. However, the insurance provided in China is quite shallow. Let's say they still require patients to pay 40% of the outpatient services or 50% of the inpatient services. So what China has to do is to also to expand its insurance benefit package to not only covering everyone, but give everyone a reasonable benefit package. That will solve the problem of financial access for the Chinese residents. Then China is doing something which is quite different from United States and other countries. That is, they are shifting their resources to basic prevention. Mm-hmm. The government are paying on a per-person basis a sum of money to the, in the rural area, they pay it to the village health post, require them to deliver 14 categories of prevention.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. William Shao, K.T. Lee Professor of Economics at Harvard School of Public Health. I'm going to claim you as a Connecticut resident. Harvard might claim you as one of the esteemed faculty there, but you actually started your career right here in Connecticut as an actuary for the Connecticut General Life Insurance Company in Hartford, a predecessor to Cigna. And that led to your appointment as the Chief Actuary of Social Security Administration in 1970. And you played a really important role in influencing legislation to bolster and preserve the Social Security system. And you can't turn on TV and listen to a political debate without the long-term financial health of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid being discussed. What advice do you have for the country's, the steps that it should take to preserve these important institutions with a focus in on those three of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid?
Social Security does not have a severe financial problems even into the 30, 50 years from now. It will have a run into a slight deficit, but by raising the retirement age a little bit, by adjusting the inflation indexing for the Social Security benefits, and control the disability program more stringently, the Social Security pension program can be put back into good health, financial health. This is a point does not get emphasized in the newspapers. They lump Social Security with Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare and Medicaid is a totally different ballgame. Healthcare costs is usually rising in the United States 2 to 4% faster than our growth in gross domestic product or the rate of growth in our income. So it's taking away a larger share of our government's budgets. It's taking away larger share of our household budgets, or it's increasing employers' costs for health insurance premium. That has to be controlled. And some serious surgery has to be done. In my work with, I show my true color with my work in from Vermont. Mm-hmm. I believe single-payer system is a solution that United States should seriously consider. Although I do not underestimate the political resistance.
Well, we're keeping a very close eye on the state of Vermont. We had Governor Peter Shumlin on our show recently talking about the Vermont move to single-payer system. And, you know, that's been talked about so often in the United States, and people say, well, it's just not possible. People won't go for it. But we may have a chance to see this experiment in Vermont, and we're going to be looking at it really carefully. And, you know, it seems to me that the issue, even for the primary care provider, is going to be, is there a shift to paying just for the services and the procedures we provide, or is it for the outcomes that we get? And you, of course, were a leader in developing something that's really only known to the healthcare people, the resource-based relative value study, or the RVS system. When you look back on the time in healthcare policy when you created that, and today, how do you think we need to change our financing and payment systems to be much more focused on the outcome of the patient than just the service that we provide? Have you rethought that initial work that you did?
Well, the initial work I did was that for a fee-for-service payment system. As I argued earlier, United States have to shift away from that payment method. the United States has to pay physicians based on per person, per patient, or per episode of illness, or per case, rather than for each item of service or each test you perform. So I think the RBRBS should be really these last days if the United States shift to a different payment method. And the United States should pay physicians some bonus for patients' outcome. Right now, physicians are paid regardless the patients got well or did not get well. In China, used to be a system, the doctor only get paid when the patients get well. Well, if we can establish a system at least that doctors are recognized and compensated more if the patients got well rather than something was done to the patient, then I think the doctors will pay more attention on healing the patients rather than what procedure can I do or what other tests can I do on this patient.
Dr. Shah, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
One of the most innovative most innovative countries are actually in Asia. Thailand adopted a payment method which all the experts consider is the most innovative one. They combine paying per person with case payment and with bonuses. And China has dozens and dozens of experiments going on throughout the country on that. And England is one which actually emphasizes primary care and prevention, and which the United States can learn a great deal from. So I would say the emerging economies are experimenting more in their country, which the United States should pay attention to. But for the industrialized countries, I would say England is the most interesting one.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. William Shao, the K.T. Lee Professor of Economics at the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Shao, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
It's my pleasure.
We close with the Tech Report, our weekly look at how people are using technology to improve health and wellness. I'm Lauren Bonner.
There you go. Come on in.
It's the first week of classes at Fairfield University's School of Nursing. The excitement of a new school year is palpable through the hallways.
Hey. Hi. How you doing there?
The dean of the School of Nursing, along with some faculty members, are eager to demonstrate the learning experience of their students.
So we're going to take you to one of the hospital rooms.
This room is where we have what we call our basic task trainer mannequins for mostly our undergrads.
A row of hospital beds face us, each separated with a curtain. Everything looks real except for the doll lying in the bed. As Diane Major, an assistant professor of nursing, tells me, undergraduate nursing students use this room to learn basic skills.
They can give a shot 100 times into a muscle.
Fairfield University's School of Nursing received its very first simulation mannequin 5 years ago. Since then, they've added more dolls and more mock hospital rooms because simulation training gives the students an opportunity to gain experience risk-free before stepping into clinical rotations. Suzanne Campbell, the dean of the School of Nursing, tells me these days the school tries to incorporate simulation training into every class, whether it's hands-on learning or through live video feeds.
So we've actually integrated it, and I can give you an example of the obstetric course. The first 10 minutes, students walk in, they are assigned. There's two or three students who are going to be part of that simulation. They have the case study, history, medications, what's going on. Meanwhile, their 30 classmates are sitting in a classroom where live videotape is being shown, and they are feeling part of the experience. They're writing down what other questions they would want to know, what would they have done first. Whereas for the nurse practitioner students, they're practicing for the clinic, and they're getting down that critical thinking mode. They're nurses, they have skills, but they now need to move to that primary care level where are they asking the questions, ordering the labs, getting the medications.
This is where the new 4-bed practice geriatric nursing simulated clinic comes in. Fairfield University received a grant last year to create a simulated primary care clinic for advanced practice nurses. In this clinic room, connected to the mock hospital room, 4 3G SimMan high-fidelity robotic mannequins sit upright on their hospital beds. What I notice first about these dolls is their clothing. Each looks different from the next, even down to skin color. Clearly, they have stories. Sheila Grossman is a professor of nursing. She explains.
Mrs. Marmalade here lives in a adult health center, and she's actually 92 and has diabetes and is cared for in that daycare center. And as you can see, she's African American. And then we actually have a soldier here who fought in the Iraqi war, and he's actually someone who was born in Iran. So he's Muslim, and we've learned a lot about his culture through working with him.
These simulation dolls help the students with advanced practice nursing, where they can bring all their skills together in an individualized scenario that could involve multiple components, like listening to a patient who can't speak English, giving a shot, and ordering the correct medication. Diane Major leads many of these unique training sessions from a laptop in the front of the clinic room. If a student gives too much medication, the mannequin can be programmed by Major via the computer to have an adverse reaction.
In a minute, he'll blink his eyes. And then could we have him, Diane, will we be able to?
So I can increase or decrease heart rate, respirations. I can make him cough, blink, sweat, tear, bleed. I can cause tremors. I can change his lung sounds, bowel sounds, pulses. When his monitor is up, I can change his cardiac rhythms.
One doll even has a tube attached to a catheter in a vein for the delivery of medicine. Some can have heart attacks too, as well as spurt blood so students can practice wound care. And they talk courtesy of faculty voicing from wireless headsets. Not only have the students found this way of learning effective, but the school has tried to make it an interdisciplinary experience. With the help from Fairfield University theater students who can act out the wailing wife or the demanding brother of a patient, the exercise becomes even more real. Eventually, the school would like to reach out to the larger Fairfield community for even more collaborative learning. But that will have to wait until they can get a bigger vehicle to transport all the mannequins.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of connecting our communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.